This is Radio Boston. I'm Tanya Mosley. In May of 1964, Martin Luther King Jr. visited Bowdoin College, a small liberal arts school in Maine that was far from the civil rights movement he was leading in the South. King spoke before a crowd that spilled out of the First Parish Church in Brunswick, Maine. He talked about the progress that the civil rights movement had made and how far it still had to go.
The hour is late. The clock of destiny is ticking out. And we must act now before it is too late. The shape of the world today does not afford America the luxury of an anemic democracy.
This recording captures King at the beginning of a year in his career which he would receive the Nobel Peace Prize and stand next to President Lyndon Johnson as Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Joining me now from Baltimore to talk about Dr. King is Taylor Branch. He is an author and historian who won a Pulitzer Prize for his book, Parting the Waters, America in the King Years. This was the first volume of a trilogy about Dr. King and the civil rights movement. Taylor Branch, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Tanya. Nice to be here.
Listening to Dr. King's speech from Bowdoin in 1964, I have to say that I got pretty emotional listening to it because it feels so timely. He could be speaking to issues we're dealing with today. I'd love to know your reaction to it.
Well, I think that's one of the distinctive things about Dr. King is that he framed issues that most of us think are just pure segregation applying only to the South, but he framed them in language about democracy itself and the larger meaning of freedom. And the discipline and the respect for it. He almost never used purely racial terms. He talked about fulfilling the democratic experiment and the true inner meaning of freedom. So he put things in very, very large terms, almost always with one foot in the scriptures and another in the Constitution. So he gave both a spiritual and a secular base to the challenge of overcoming our differences.
One foot in the scripture and the other in the Constitution. At the time of the speech, we were entering the height of the civil rights movement. Can you tell us more about where Dr. King was in his career at that time?
Well, this is May 1964. He had just come from St. Augustine, Florida, and was about to go back there to jail. It has an interesting New England connection because the mother of the governor of Massachusetts, Mrs. Peabody, the mother of Endicott Peabody, the governor, was in jail in St. Petersburg. She went down there with her purse and her pearls and went to jail in one of the most violent areas that Dr. King served. And he came from St. Augustine up to give these speeches, including the one at Bowdoin, and then went back down there and went to jail with her, or actually she got out before he went in, but also in the same movement. And the overarching reality was that the Civil Rights Bill of 64 was being filibustered in the Senate all through May. It had been filibustered since February, the longest filibuster in American history. So this was the Civil Rights Movement was up or down on the legislation to end segregation that the movement had been crusading for basically 10 years, ever since the Brown decision in 1954. So this was really a pivotal time for him personally, because he did say that St. Augustine was the scariest place he ever was until that time. And also politically, because the Civil Rights Bill of 64 was hanging in the balance.
I'm going to ask you questions about his Boston ties in just a moment, but I want to go back to that speech specifically at Bowdoin College. He talks about three attitudes towards equality: the extreme optimist who thinks that we've made meaningful strides in race relations. Then there's the extreme pessimist who thinks that we've only made minor strides in the area of race relations and that perhaps we're regressing. And then the realist, combining the truths of two opposites while avoiding the extremes of both. I'd love for you to talk a bit about this idea of the three attitudes that shaped Dr. King's mission and perhaps its meaning for us today.
That was a common theme in his speeches. And, of course, the really important thing about it is that the extreme attitudes on either side, that time will solve this, we don't need to get involved, things are getting better, and it's hopeless. Don't get involved with it at all. What they have in common is that both of them say we don't really need to get involved because it's either hopeless or it's taking care of itself. So what they have in common is a way of avoiding the issue and not delving into it yourself. The middle road that Dr. King recommended, he said, is hard because it requires you to reach outside yourself and get involved with people and ideas that are not comfortable for you in a determination to overcome those gaps and differences and make justice and freedom real. So he was always plagued by that. He was plagued by people saying time will take care of it, and he would say, no, time is neutral. We can and have gone backwards in race relations in our history, and time is only what we make of it. And so there's that distinctive anguish in his voice, because he's very idealistic and he's talking about how our scriptures and the Constitution provide for a historic freedom to the world, and yet you hear all the anguish in his voice because he's realistic enough to know how much avoidance and how much hostility and how much fear there is across the racial lines that divided America then and still do today.
And you touched on that in his voice. I thought of it as a somber-sounding voice, but you characterize it in a different way. Let's play another piece of tape from Dr. King's speech at Bowdoin in 1964.
I'm convinced that we will have to repent in this generation, not merely for the vitriolic words and the violent actions of the bad people who will bomb a church in Birmingham, Alabama, but for the appalling silence of the good people. Human progress never rolls in on the wheels of inevitability. It comes through the tireless efforts and the persistent work of dedicated individuals who are willing to be co-workers with God, and without this hard work, time itself becomes an ally of the primitive forces of social stagnation.
Taylor, this sounds like a direct message to Northerners at the time. Can you expound on that, and is that true?
Well, he spoke in the North more than he spoke in the South, simply because he could get more audiences there, and that's where he was raising money. Mm-hmm. And but he gave more or less that same message in the South, too, because there were plenty of people. The year before, his classic letter from Birmingham jail was written to Southern liberals in much the same language that you heard there, that they were sitting on the sidelines and that they were making excuses not to get involved, and they were saying that King may be right in principle, but it was wrong to demonstrate in Birmingham and that it made people uncomfortable. So he gave that kind of speech constantly. Now, he was headed toward the North with his movement itself, but the very next year, in 1965, but the excerpt that you've been playing are from 64, which was kind of the climactic year of legislation to address the segregation laws in the South.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk.
There wasn't a single elected official in all the Confederate states, nobody in the Congress, and to my knowledge, no mayor who endorsed repealing the segregation law. So it really was a pretty solid phalanx. The first mayor who came out against them was Ivan Allen, my mayor in Atlanta. I'm from Atlanta, and that wasn't until the Civil Rights Bill was actually introduced and before Congress. So it was pretty daunting of the civil rights movement to tackle a region that was that uniformly committed to those segregation laws that prevented black people even from going into libraries and schools, and far beyond schools and even churches, of course, when the movement had so few traditional tools in politics. They didn't have much money, they didn't have any newspapers, they didn't have an army or a police force, and they were largely invisible. So it was a pretty brave movement.
This is important history. I think many times when we reflect on that time in history, we just think about the accomplishments that have happened over time and not thinking about all of that went into making those accomplishments happen. I'd love to talk with you a bit about his time in Boston. Dr. King got his PhD at Boston University in 1955 here. He met his wife, Coretta, here, and he formed a deep connection with Howard Thurman, Herman, the then dean of BU's Marsh Chapel. I'd love for you to share with us a bit about how those relationships here in Boston shaped Dr. King and his work ultimately.
Well, Howard Thurman was Dr. King's constant temptation. He admired him deeply. He loved his work. He loved the work of a lot of thinkers. He had profound relations with people as varied as Abraham Heschel, the Orthodox Jewish rabbi, and Thich Nhat Hanh, who's still an international master teacher of Buddhist nonviolence from Vietnam. So he had a lot of kind of profound connections. But Howard Thurman was dean of the chapel up there, and for Dr. King, he would always be tempted to say, I want to go up there and have a job like Howard Thurman so I don't have to keep going to jail in St. Augustine.
Right.
I want to get off the front lines. But he could never quite do it. He could never, he was a conscience-driven person, and he could never quite leave the front lines of the movement. But he loved being there in Boston. He loved studying for his PhD. He loved the kind of life that it was kind of an ideal vacation for him to imagine himself being out of the movement and comfortable and living an intellectual life like Howard Thurman did.
His constant temptation, as you call it. What type of reception did he receive in Boston from both the white and the African-American community?
Well, the white community was mostly shock in the sense of, what are you doing here? This is Boston. We don't have any segregation laws here. Mm. The best way, an amusing way to get at it was that the people around Dr. King invented a nickname for Elliot Richardson, who was the lieutenant governor, I believe, at the time, and who met Dr. King in 65 in Selma. And a number of people, including some martyrs, went south from the Boston area, James Reeb and Jonathan Daniels from the Boston area. But then Dr. King came straight from Selma to Boston. It was the first city that he tested out for a northern movement. That was dedicated to prove, he said, or to wake America up to the fact that the race issue was not and never had been purely sectional. And he tested Boston as the first of the northern cities, and he ultimately decided not to do it. I don't think because of the reaction of the white people. They called Elliot Richardson, by the way, I was with you in Selma, because every time they would start talking to him about problems and segregation and prejudice and economic inequality in Boston area, he would say, I was with you in Selma.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning he Richardson, was comfortable being down there in Selma supporting Dr. King, but he was not comfortable talking about a potential movement of demonstrations on racial injustice in Boston.
When it comes to the black community specifically,
Boston was also divided, and that's ultimately, Dr. King tried out 7 cities, including Boston, but ultimately launched his northern movement to show that racial barriers were a national issue in Chicago in early 1966.
What was the divide among the African-American community?
Well, quite frankly, when you get behind the scenes, the movement is personal, and the people there felt that it would reflect badly on them if he came there, because they wanted to project, they wanted, their official view was that they had race relations in pretty good hands. They thought it would reflect badly on their leadership if Dr. King came there to have marches and demonstrations to draw people's attention and try to change people's perspective on the way they looked at race relations in Boston, because he thought there was a complacency there. But he ultimately decided that the various groups there, the civil rights groups, the NAACP, the Urban League, the various leaders, and particularly the church leaders, were too divided and too resistant to the notion of his coming to Boston, because, frankly, it made it look like they needed his help, and they didn't like that.
He did come back here in 1965. And he led the civil rights march from the South End to the Boston Common. And he said, quote, the vision of the new Boston must extend into the heart of Roxbury. Boston must be the testing ground for the ideals of freedom. So I'll tell you, like, I'm thinking about education, housing.
That was the trip that he took to Boston, the first trip in 65.
So this was his first one that you were talking about.
That's right. It was within a month of Selma. It was like April 23rd, 1965, something like that.
How do you
think... The speech you just quoted.
Yes. How do you think, when we think about education and housing and wage and job disparities at the center of many of the discussions we're having today, how do you think Dr. King would view America's current climate?
Well, I think that he would say we haven't made a lot of progress on inner-city segregation and displacement of jobs. Remember, he was talking about automation and job displacement and the fact that black workers who had migrated to the North after World War I and World War II for factory jobs were the first people to get displaced by automation. Now that kind of we call it globalization now, but now that's displacing even lawyers' jobs and middle-class jobs and Trump voters' jobs who are insecure about work given international competition. But that's been a fact of life for black people who've been the first ones displaced and the first ones confined in certain areas of the city, you know, going back into the 19th century. So these are not new issues for Martin Luther King.
Let's listen to another moment from Dr. King's speech at Bowdoin in 1964.
The days are now difficult, the moments are now dark, but I still sing with those who are singing it by the thousands now in the theme song of our movement, "We Shall Overcome." And I believe this because somehow the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice.
We heard this same line from President Obama during his final address to the nation last week in Chicago. I'd love for you to talk for a moment about the significance of these words from both Dr. King and President Obama.
Well, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. King made that comment so many times that many people think it was his. He's actually quoting Theodore Parker, who was an abolitionist from New England. And President Obama quoted it because I think President Obama is equally devoted to the notion of democracy and justice and freedom being a long-range project. The American experiment was considered preposterous, that, you know, we could get along in spite of our differences without a king or an army to order us about and tell us what to do. So Dr. King loved this quote, and he loved the fact that it was we, you know, we shall overcome, which derives straight from we the people, which is the fundamental optimism and groundedness of, you know, that's the first three words in the Constitution. So the interesting thing about the movement is that because people there lack traditional weapons to raise consciousness and move people to a higher plane on interracial relations, they had to stay up all night debating what roots they could find in the American tradition and where it would intersect with spiritual values and religious values in ways that would move people who were basically either didn't know about it or who were frightened about the idea of being engaged with black people at that time. So they went for very deep sources and very traditional sources, and it's not surprising that they would connect to the arc of the moral universe to a slogan from the abolitionist era and to sayings from the American Revolution and of course straight out of the Bible as well.
We are talking to Pulitzer Prize winning author of the trilogy detailing the life of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., America and the King Years. Thank you so much for joining us. It was a privilege to talk to you.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Radio Boston. We'll be right back.